Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
Rather than having to drive around on patrol, they could sit there and drink tea with Iraqis someplace and have a guy out in their Humvee moving their little blip around on the screen so that headquarters would think they were actually moving around and on patrol.
Today we hear part one of our series on finding the will to resist war. That is the theme of Dar Jamail's upcoming tour of Connecticut, where he will discuss his new book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. Despite promises of a more peaceful and diplomatic U.S. strategy, President Obama is moving ahead with strategies that will depend on the use of force. Bogged down in Iraq, the military keeps escalating the war in Afghanistan, that despite an obvious lack of available personnel and public support. On September 19th, 20th, and 21st, Dar Jamail will speak to students, veterans, and the general public at six locations in Connecticut. He will be in Willimantic at the Wrench in the Works Collective and Eastern Connecticut State University, in stores at the University of Connecticut's Dodd Center, in Hartford at the Hope Out Loud Festival, in New Britain at Central Connecticut State University, and in Middletown at Wesleyan University, where he will share the stage with singer-songwriter David Rovix. Connecticut is Obama country, and support for the president continues. Yet peace activists here hope to also make it Dar Jamail country. They're concerned about civilian lives, money for war that could be used for social programs at home. But they are also concerned about the U.S. soldiers serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they're heavily supported by U.S. veterans groups with similar goals. Right now, the U.S. is sending even decorated war heroes and injured soldiers to prison, detention at the dreaded Echo Platoon facility and others like it, for refusing to deploy to Iraq or Afghanistan. Thousands of wounded soldiers are being deployed, and the lives of hundreds of thousands of soldiers are in the balance. They're being asked to serve a policy that is running in the background of the Obama White House like the rogue computer in the film War Games. Joining us once again, journalist Dar Jamail. Dar, welcome.
Thanks, Dori.
We've been looking at a lot of news on Afghanistan, and I want to start there. Are we really looking at a war that will prevent the kind of safe haven that the president is talking about for al-Qaeda? Or are we looking at a continuation of the kind of advance toward building bases and securing this whole region that we saw when we were talking about the Bush administration prior to Obama's election?
It's clearly the latter, Dori. There's really no question in my mind whatsoever. I mean, when we hear President Obama standing up there talking about using the superlatives that you just talked about, you know, war on terror and the just war and the preservation of Western civilization depends on it, this kind of thing. I mean, this is, he's really channeling George W. Bush because he's really actually engaged in using the propaganda to conceal the fact that we have the same U.S. agenda now as we did last year and the year before that and the 6 years before that and the 20 years before that. We're looking at the U.S. Empire Project, and we're looking at a continuation of the same national security strategy, the same Quadrennial Defense Review report, the same Secretary of Defense, and just about all of the same high-ranking echelons in the Pentagon that we had under Bush. We have the same under President Obama, and of course the same corporate interests at work today as we did last year and the year before that and the decades, a lot of the decades before that. So we look at a situation in Afghanistan where we have four major U.S. military bases located specifically along a proposed pipeline route, the same proposed pipeline route that brought the Taliban over to this country under the Bush administration for meetings, the same proposed pipeline route that the Clinton administration had engaged in talks with the Taliban about. And those obviously didn't work, so we have to use war as politics, and that's exactly what it is. So, you know, as the last resort of politics, the U.S. decides to invade and occupy the country to defend its so-called national security interests, which are the shipping lanes, in this case the shipping pipelines, for natural resources and control of those. And that's what this is all about.
Just explain some of what is actually in the film, The Bases Are Loaded, and why Americans should be considering the kinds of things you were saying in that film and Chalmers Johnson, the scholar, also said.
I have in front of me a few lines that I want to read you. I want to quote from the National Security Strategy of the United States. It was most recently updated in March 2006, See, it hasn't even been updated under the Obama administration. Granted, this is not an odd thing to have happen because this is a very huge document that determines U.S. foreign policy, and it's not updated on a regular basis. So it's not really an anomaly that the Obama administration hasn't updated it. But again, it ties in with what we were talking about before, is we have a same continuation of policy. We've basically had a very effective brand change of the U.S. empire project from Bush into Obama, and it fooled a lot of people abroad, and it fooled even more people here at home, and continues to fool a lot of people who actually think that Barack Obama is going to bring about quote-unquote change. But let me read a little bit about the national security strategy. Let me just read you a couple of its missions. Here's one, quote, ignite a new era of global economic growth through free markets and free trade, and, quote, pressing for open markets, financial stability, and deeper integration of the world economy. This is the U.S. foreign policy. And it goes on to say that the future strategy of U.S. foreign policy involves, quote, opening markets and integrating developing countries, and, quote, reforming the international financial system to ensure stability and growth. And, I mean, we can go on. I mean, there is so much, and maybe in a little bit I'll read a little bit more. But the point is that this document, coupled with the Quadrennial Defense Review Report, between the two, they very clearly outline what is U.S. foreign policy, and then how is the U.S. military going to be used to enact that policy. And when you look at what U.S. foreign policy is, and again, this is where if you walk down the street and ask the average person, what specifically is the U.S. foreign policy, and what specifically drives and determines that policy? Most people aren't going to be able to tell you. But I'm sitting here saying, and we've talked about this before, Dory, that it's the National Security Strategy and the Quadrennial Defense Review Report. These are two of the most important documents that generate and outline and explain what is U.S. foreign policy. And here we have the National Security Strategy talking about economics. It's not talking about 9/11. That's just the pretense. It's not talking about security of the United States and protecting the people and defending and supporting the Constitution. It's talking about economics. People need to really take that deep inside that, you know, when you look and see Barack Obama, you're looking at a guy up there arguing and giving these eloquently written speeches in defense of U.S. global hegemony, and it's all about economics, and it's all about dominating and controlling the globe in order to come out on top economically. And don't take my word for it. Read these documents. It's all right there.
It seems both U.S. and British commanders are referring to security needs when it comes to the operations in Afghanistan. Here is British Defense Secretary Bob Ainsworth calling for public support for the operation in August.
The Afghan government under the Taliban sheltered Al-Qaeda, allowed them bases, and as a result we were directly attacked, and they will do that again. This is about our national interest. The other thing I think that the British public worry about is whether or not it's winnable. You know, they want to see some progress. There is progress, but it's not necessarily appreciated back here.
You know, at this point, we've got 200 British soldiers killed in Afghanistan. 726 U.S. soldiers have died there and in Pakistan and Uzbekistan since 2001. 44 U.S. soldiers have died in the month of August alone. What should we make of this new language about winning these wars? And again, you know, security.
I think we distract ourselves when we talk about the language that they're using there in the media as propaganda. I think we need to talk about the language that they use in their documents because it's much more revealing. Because by the time it reaches the media, they have to defend their policy. They have to defend the fact that over 5,000 U.S. troops have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, and defend the fact that well over 75,000 U.S. troops have been wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan, and defend the fact that their policies have effectively killed well over 1.4 million people between Iraq and Afghanistan, and defend the fact that it's cost this country well over $1 trillion at this point to occupy both Iraq and Afghanistan. I think we need to really look beyond their propaganda and deeper at what's generating it. And I hope to reveal this in a way that it really surprises people and upsets people. Of course, hopefully then people will realize that kind of the onus is on us, that if anything's going to change here, it's not going to be because an articulate, charismatic Barack Obama is talking about it, but that, you know, as all real change has ever happened in the history of this country, or the history of the world for that matter, it's only because people force it to happen. And what needs to change is the national security strategy. Let me read you another sentence from the national security strategy. It talks specifically about the Middle East. Quote, "We seek a Middle East of independent states at peace with each other and fully participating in an open global market of goods, services, and ideas." And then, of course, we can talk about the Quadrennial Defense Review Report, where there it says that the stated ability of the U.S. military is to fight, quote, "multiple overlapping wars and to ensure that all major and emerging powers are integrated as constructive actors and stakeholders into the international system." We're talking again about the economic system, we're talking again about free markets, and we're talking again about the U.S. being in control of those. So contrast that with, for example, the oath that people swear when they join the military, and you go through basic training and you're becoming a soldier, and then you swear an oath that tells you that your duty as a service person is to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. So is that your oath? Or is your oath to, as it says in the Quadrennial Defense Review Report, quote, "As a soldier, my oath is to, quote, ensure that all major and emerging powers are integrated as constructive actors and stakeholders into the international system." I just really don't think it can be much clearer. And again, when people see that, like, this is our U.S. foreign policy, it's all about economics. It's all about making a few select, rich, fat, white guys in suits that much richer. It's not about defending the United States. It's not about liberating Iraqis or helping people in Afghanistan. It's not about any of that. It's all about profit. And that's what all of this is about. And against that backdrop and in that context, I think people should be absolutely shocked, disgusted, and outraged every day that all of this continues to happen in their name. And not only is it continuing to happen, but as we see very clearly, you know, daily, things in Afghanistan now are getting more out of control. Last month was the single deadliest month in the entire occupation for NATO and U.S. forces. And this month now, as of right now, U.S. forces were tied with last month. Certainly, we're going to set a new record this month.
In fact, we did see a rise of civilian casualties in Afghanistan, 24% at the start of this year under Barack Obama. Now, they've backed away from some of the bombing that was causing those civilian casualties in Afghanistan itself. But with the scenario unfolding, the U.S. in Helmand province, that's pretty much where we hold any territory, the Taliban strengthening in the south, and it's looking as if the U.S., unless they can miraculously bring in many, many, many more soldiers instantly that they apparently don't have, really, they're going to have to resort to airstrikes if they want to do what the U.S. military tends to do, which is take one town, then the next. And so we're going to see a lot more civilian casualties, aren't we? Just talk about the way people find themselves getting disillusioned serving in the force when they were thinking that they were there to protect civilians.
Well, and this is really key because this is, I think, what has really started to cause more and more people in the military to question what's happening and what are they being used for, and, oh, maybe I should actually resist this. As opposed to, as we said, you know, a lot of people sign up buying the propaganda that, hey, I want to serve my country, I'm going to get all these things the recruiter told me, including not have to go to Iraq and Afghanistan, I'm going to get all these benefits, I'm going to get all this money for college, I'm not going to have to go into combat, this is for the good of the country, or, and if I do get sent over there, it's to help these people. And instead, what I keep finding with all these people I talked about, talked with in order to work on the book, and then those I've been talking with and conducting interviews more recently, so common to hear that people said, look, I went over there to Iraq or Afghanistan, and instead of finding that we were doing work to actually help people or improve the country, I found that we were actually destroying, doing nothing but destroying the country, that, you know, we had bombed it to smithereens, and then instead of all this promised reconstruction that we were told was going to happen to, we're just driving around waiting to get blown up by roadside bombs. We're killing civilians. We're raiding their homes. We're stealing from them. You know, we just basically destroyed the country. And as one fellow, Michael Kern, an Iraq vet who's still active duty at Fort Hood, who told me up at Fort Hood about 2 weeks ago, he said, I went to Iraq and I realized that there really weren't terrorists over there. I realized that I was the terrorist.
When you were in Iraq, you reported on a wide variety of news stories, but we could discuss them in categories, let's say, and there is this one category we could call survival. Iraqis trying to survive, talking with you, sharing with you what they were going through, but you did report on the day-to-day effort they had to make in order to live. Compare that with what you're noticing as you talk to members of the U.S. military, because I found myself wondering if some of these GIs are actually experiencing some of the very same problems of wondering how they're going to make it through the very unique challenges they're facing.
They do. Folks coming back, soldiers specifically, they have PTSD, and they come back and they have to deal with what's going on, and that's because when they were over there, they were put into positions where they had to do a lot of horrible things. And you know, I talk with people who are very frank with me. For example, Seth Manziel, who I talk about in the book, who's now up in Washington State, and he's since helped found a GI resistance coffee house called Coffee Strong, and also a pirate radio station that's broadcasting information into Fort Lewis, into the base, trying to educate soldiers, doing things like broadcasting Martin Luther King speeches and Democracy Now! Episodes and things like this. And Seth told me that, he said, look, when I was over there, I was a vehicle commander, and we drove like crazy. We ran cars off the road. We shot in the air. We terrorized people because we were so afraid that we decided we were just going to do whatever we had to do to survive and get back in one piece. And then that, fortunately for a lot of soldiers, translated into doing other things. Like, you know what, instead of actually even going out on these patrols, let's figure out a way not to do that. Because when we go out on patrols, all we do is jeopardize our lives and, of course, the lives of Iraqis. And so Seth, of course, went on to tell me that he, along with several other soldiers, had learned how to manipulate the location of his patrol on a computer screen so that rather than having to drive around on patrol, they could sit there and drink tea with Iraqis someplace and have a guy out in their Humvee moving their little blip around on the screen so the headquarters would think they were actually moving around and on patrol. And I interviewed several different people that told me the same story, and then I interviewed several different people that told me of actually going out physically and faking a patrol by, like, going to a field and parking their Humvees and, again, calling in every hour and saying, yeah, we're still searching this field for weapons caches, and not actually doing anything, just sitting out there, not patrolling, and then going back to base at the end of their patrol. And that's become really, really common as well. But then, again, when these folks come home, regardless of most of their situations, they have a really difficult time coming back into society and have to then kind of relearn how to integrate themselves back into society because they come from these really horrible occupations and come back home. And then again, the military is not really doing enough to bring people back home and reintegrate them and debrief them properly, and certainly not doing enough to deal with their post-traumatic stress disorder. So, and then, of course, that sets the stage for a different kind of resistance once they get back home.
We talk about PTSD. I want to sort of go beyond that label and take apart some of what's behind it, because it seems to me that soldiers, if I can just imagine their lives, would have left one America. They're serving that country in Iraq, becoming deeply disillusioned, of course, finding all kinds of command decisions that were very challenging to have to live with. As we understand it, there were no less than 4 different operational methods as the U.S. entered Iraq in 2003. Lots of blunders. Making a new U.S. flag for the Iraqi people in 2004. Lots of crazy kinds of blunders. So they have first the home reality, then the Iraq reality, and the military reality, and then they come home again to yet a new country, really, a different political and social climate. And so how do they effectively transition their lives under these kinds of challenging circumstances? You know, I almost wonder if in some cases we're talking about societal problems, not just a problem to lay on the soldier, him or her, you know?
Without a question, we're talking about both, Dory. And I'll start talking about PTSD from personal experience, because all of us who go over to Iraq or Afghanistan, and whether we're journalists or in the military or contractors or whatever, that any of us that actually go out and experience the occupation. So I'm being very clear that, as opposed to people, like, there's a lot of people that go to Iraq, for example, and never leave the green zone, literally. Journalists and soldiers and contractors alike that literally will go over there and spend a year there and never leave. And I've talked to these people. So I'm not talking about those people. although they'll certainly have maybe some things to work out when they come home too. But those of us who actually go out there and see the violence and experience it firsthand and see how it's affecting people around us, that it's impossible to come back home unscathed. And so when you're in that kind of environment, in any kind of war, you basically have to start putting on psychological armor to protect yourself, and spiritual armor for that matter, that it's such a horrible situation that you can't walk into it completely open, or you would just be completely devastated internally by it. And this is my personal experience, because I did walk into it completely open way back when we first started talking back in December 2003, and it affected me deeply. You know, but when you stay in that environment, you have to start taking care of yourself, and that means you basically have to start shutting down certain parts of yourself. Like, you can't allow yourself to experience all of this stuff completely acutely on a daily basis, or I think you'd probably go mad. And so you start kind of closing off a bit and becoming a bit hardened and kind of stuffing a lot of feelings and such. But the problem, and that works, that takes care of you, and journalists and soldiers do it alike. But the problem is, over time, it gets to where you really can't feel anything. And by the time I got back from Iraq, and this is how I really bonded and I think won the trust and respect and kind of really comradeship with a lot of the soldiers I interviewed in The Will to Resist, was that you come back home and basically all you can feel is rage. You can't feel anything else, because you come back out of this horrible situation and you come back to the United States, where it's like Disneyland by comparison, where so many people here walking around just unawares that these wars are even happening, and certainly not making any kind of sacrifices in their lives to try to end them. And you walk around in this environment, you know, like maybe you've been in Baghdad a week earlier, as was the case with me, like walking through morgues looking at body parts laying on gurneys that your tax dollars funded. And then you come back here and people's biggest concern is like, what do they want to get on their pizza that night? Or where's my next vacation going to be? And, you know, that's a little upsetting, and that causes this huge disparity. There's this huge gap then that you really can't cross, and so you feel really isolated, and you really can't relate to these people back here, even though you were really close to them before you went overseas. And then now, what becomes more normal is Iraq and Afghanistan, because that's real, and that's what's happening. And over here, it's Disneyland, and this is fake. This isn't, you know, this isn't what most people are having to live with. And so it's a really kind of crazy-making situation, and we all need to get help with that. We all need to talk to a counselor. We all need to take care of ourselves and learn how to live with that disparity and kind of work these things out, and even more, like, you know, talk about and work through the things that we saw over there that caused the trauma in the first place. But then to talk about, what does that say about our society here, where here we are living in the belly of the beast, so to speak, living in the empire, where here is the genesis of this military that's been going around occupying these countries and generating so much death and strife and suffering. And, you know, all of our tax dollars, or roughly 50% of all of our tax dollars, are going to fund the military in some way, shape, or form. And so, you know, what does that do to us spiritually to live in a society? You know, we all intrinsically know this stuff, whether people want to try to ignore it and act like it's not happening or not. We all intrinsically know that we're living in a very privileged place, and that it's costing the rest of the world a lot for us to get to live this way. And so I think, you know, a kind of a bigger existential question is then, what does that do to us? You know, what does that do to us as a society and a culture and a country to live with this disparity that keeps getting more wide? It's widening by the day.
You know, I remember those winters, 2003, very well, Dar, and I remember speaking with you over the holidays, Christmas and New Year's, and then, you know, heading home and stopping here and there. I tried to pick up a few presents, and it just was surreal. Just the whole universe of the mall, you know, and then trying to imagine what it's like actually in Iraq, as you obviously were experiencing, and as you put in your book, Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. Dar Jamil, his second book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. That book has a foreword by Chris Hedges, his first book a foreword by Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman. Dar, when you speak to GIs, I know I'm reminded of some of what you were writing about Iraqis when I read what you've written about U.S. GIs, because you're describing a three-dimensional human being, not just a news situation. You really are interested in people quite clearly. And I've wondered, you know, do some of these soldiers cry? I know you've written about the Iraqis that you were interviewing just breaking down and weeping at times when you did interview them. And there were some exceptions, and we can talk about those, the gentleman that you interviewed just before the first U.S. siege on Fallujah. You there drawing a story about actually how the resistance was formed. But how do these soldiers come across? Are they vulnerable? Are they allowing themselves to be vulnerable?
Well, I think just by talking to the press about their situation, they're allowing themselves to be vulnerable. And I think, you know, because this in itself is a radical act, because, you know, they're coming out of a military that basically tells them that, look, when you sign the dotted line, you have no rights. We own you, and you can't question anything, and you're just only to do what you're told, and, you know, you're not supposed to think about anything. You're supposed to just follow orders and be a good soldier. And in reality is that that even goes against what the Uniform Code of Military Justice tells soldiers to do, which is the law they have to abide by as a soldier, which says, you know, A, they're not ever supposed to follow an illegal order. They are allowed to petition a commander. They are allowed to petition Congress. They are allowed to have a civilian attorney. They are allowed to file for conscientious objector status if they realize that's what they need to do. I mean, they do have a lot of rights, and so that means they have to think for themselves, which, of course, runs contrary to what the military wants them to think, because they just want robots. So when these men and women come out and talk to me or any other journalist or someone on the radio about their experience, that's a radical act for them. That's a really, really big step when we appreciate that they came out of this context of such a repressive military environment. And when they've done that, my experience with them is that, you know, I have talked to people that have been, you know, when they start talking, and a lot of the time they'll say things like, I've never told this to anybody before, or they will cry, or they will share with you things that they've been keeping to themselves for a long, long time. So it's a really profound experience for them. And to me, I really have utmost respect for these people in the military, both active duty and people who've been discharged, who are coming out and talking about, look, this was my experience. This is what they taught us in boot camp. This is what I did when I was over there, and I'm coming back and I'm talking to you now because I believe it's wrong. And it's really, really profound. And then to take it the next step, some of these folks that I've been talking with recently, some of these Afghanistan war resistors, people like Victor Augusto and Travis Bishop, who are very clearly articulating things like the UN Charter and international law and the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution that says we have to abide by that, and the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and getting very, very clear about the fact that not only Iraq, but the occupation of Afghanistan is in violation of international and domestic law as well. And therefore, as a soldier, since I swore to uphold and defend the Constitution, I can't follow that order because that's an illegal order.
We will hear part two of this discussion next time as Dar Jamil tells us about his big story of the year, the truth about what is happening to thousands of U.S. soldiers trying desperately to go home, stay home, or not deploy to war at all. You can find Dar Jamil's books, the 2008 Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, and 2009, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. Both are at his website, dar.org, dahr.org. Again, Dar Jamil will be in Connecticut from September 19th through the 21st. There's a full schedule of events at willtoresistwar.blogspot.com. There are two more webs to remember, girightshotline.org or centeronconscience.org, and we'll link to both of them, the Center on Conscience and War. You can call the GI Rights Hotline at 877-477-4487. If you're in need of accurate military counseling or information on military discharges, AWOL, and UA, or basic GI rights. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced at our studios in Storrs, Connecticut. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.